You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. You're listening to Sound Poetry, Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FM. And I'm your host, David Gilmore, presenting you today a poet who has had, well, actually many lives. She's had many decades to have many lives. A former scientist, she is a hard of hearing poet. And so she's had a somewhat tranquil and quiet approach to much of her life, perhaps. The poems of Sylvia Byrne Pollock are what we're going to be regaled with this morning. And welcome to Sound Poetry, Sylvia.
Oh, thank you so much, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've had poems in journals like Floating Bridge Review, Crab Creek Review, Stillwater Review, lots of them. You've been a pushcart nominee, and you won a couple of awards, the 2013 Mason Road Literary Award, and you're with the Jack Straw Writer in 2019. What a good company that is to belong to. You've recently been a resident poet, was it?
Yes. It's a wonderful organization down in the little town of Mineral on the slopes of Mount Rainier. And it's been going a few years now, and they have wonderful residencies where they take good care of you, and you really are encouraged for 2 weeks to just focus and write.
Oh, how nice. And what an environment in which to do it.
Yeah, it's perfect.
But what you are so happy about, and it probably feels pretty fresh, your publication of Risking It, the name of your collection, 2021. This is 2022, but I'm sure you're still feeling how fresh it is and how good it was to get that out there.
Yes, yeah. But it's hard to release a book in the pandemic. And as many of my friends have found, you know, because we weren't able to go out and do readings and the usual things. So,
well, Sound Poetry had its invention with Steve, really conjuring up the idea of what a poet's going to do in the plague years, except twiddle their thumbs. No, they'll be writing poems and they'll want to recite them, speak them. So he suggested that we do that. And it's been a very fruitful couple of years so far, and we're on the third. So you've got a lovely series of poems to read, and I want you to read as many as you can. And we're going to begin on exploration, an aesthetic view of something that has also ramifications of great profundity, Risking It. That's the name of your book. And this is the poem that goes with it.
Mm-hmm. Risking It. If it's confidently proclaimed, a name for this large orange mushroom glistening in rain beside a Galliano Island trail, does that make it safe to eat? Is it better simply to admire its vibrant copper flesh, the way it binds raindrops, stands alone in a patch of small ferns and grasses? Suppose a mycologist quotes genus and species, shows drawings in an atlas. Will it be tantalizing enough to take this lush fungus into the kitchen, saute it with shallots, make a risotto? These are the questions faced every day. Who to trust? What to eat? How to prepare for death.
Right. And what a wonderful sautéed death meal that could be if you didn't prepare it properly. But it's there to enjoy in many ways, to look at. Yeah, wonderful turn. That many may not know, the Amanita muscaria perhaps is the one that you refer to here. Is that right?
It's a possibility. I don't know what that mushroom was. I took a picture of it. But of course, it brought up that idea of the Amanita, where, you know, it could be okay. It might not be.
Yes, that's right. There's so many orangey, coppery colored ones. Right. Yes. But that's it. Dare you eat that mushroom. Very good. We're going to be risking it with my guesses. Like, that was just a guess. I'm going to be risking it if I say too much, aren't I? let's go on with something that is somewhat personal, and it is an agenda of sorts that needs to get out periodically. What the condition is by which one has real troubles in the world with communication. Let us hear how you've approached it. Prayer falling on deaf ears.
Now, this poem was inspired by one by Elizabeth Austin, a prayer poem, and gave me this idea. And so prayer falling on deaf ears. Dear God, please send a decoder, an angel with mellifluous voice, to perch in the rim of my ear. Make her multi-armed so she can catch, parse, and juggle the staccato bursts of racket, soaring sibilance that pass for human speech. Let her have a device to analyze the incoming cacophony, assemble syllables. Give her an algorithm to detect possible words in English, try them out for meaning in the context of a rapid conversation. What I'm saying, God, is that she must be fast, perceptive, imaginative, and indefatigable. Try her out on those words. If you can't detail an angel to me, perhaps you can put video displays on the forehead of each person I meet. Like supertitles at the opera, their words will scroll gently across, riding the wrinkles. If you'll do this, I promise to stop nodding inanely, laughing or looking serious at the wrong time. I will be a credit to your handiwork. If you decide to answer me, God, please stand squarely in front of me. Let me see your lips when you speak.
So witty. so much fun in that, too. Try out those words, for example. That was really, really good. And also the idea that we've done an awful lot of listening to your commands and demands and commandments and whatnot. When this happens, stand right in front of me.
Exactly.
Let me see your lips moving for once. Prove it.
You can imagine what the pandemic has been like with not being able to see people's faces because of the face masks. So,
very much so. I thought about it yesterday when my wife said, you know, I don't think you've cut your nose hairs for a very long time, David. And I said, well, I haven't had to. I'm under a mask all day long. So, things you learn, stupid things too. But, well, let's go on to the next one, Sylvia. This is really, really good. The next one also follows on the experience of hard of hearing, deafness.
So I have a series in the book of deaf woman poems, which are modeled on the Marvin Bell's Deaf Man poems. So I took, you know, some of the conceits from his structures, and although they've changed a lot over time, but when I use a number of words to say the same thing, that's very much a Marvin Bell kind of thing. So what the deaf woman can't hear. The deaf woman doesn't hear the screams from the gas chambers. The gas chambers are silent as far as she's concerned, but the stench is remarkable. Interestingly, no one talks about it, a form of politeness, like ignoring the hiccup, the belch, the fart. The camps are wonders of efficiency, debasement, sadism, torture, murder, with their tawdry tattoos, blue numbers on forearms, stacked bunks in the barracks, rotten rations. What comes next in my country, wonders the deaf woman, the disabled woman, the disposable woman.
and you have a period at the end. I thought to myself, did you put a period there because I could continue that with another adjective in our time with the Roe versus Wade and stuff that's happening? I mean, what is happening here?
Yes.
The disregard of a great population who have concerns. Yeah. Very good. That one really speaks to a truth and a fact, and yet brings up those bodily behaviors that are again part of the wit that you incorporate even in a poem that has such a profound idea there. What comes next in my country? Can't forget that as a question to be thought about periodically.
Yes.
And you do italicize that so that it's noticed. Yes. Well, I really think that that you've hit on some wonderful inventions and ways of moving an audience with thoughts that probably are not quite so common in poetry. Mm. You know, about not hearing, because poetry is, I think, performed and heard.
Yeah, it's
a language that's oral and, uh-huh. and it really goes to the heart when you hear the sounds and that. Not the same way when you just look at the word.
Yes.
Seems inert somehow on a page sometimes.
Yeah.
But you are a flagrant poet. and we're going in flagrante here with some blossoms.
Oh, you're wonderful. Flagrance. Our cherry tree was sick, girdled by larking teenage boys, bark cut so deep, sap couldn't flow between roots and leaves. Yet in its final year, before we had to cut it down, that tree put out such an extravagance of blooms, produced so many cherries, there were enough for both the crows and us. Dying trees do this, an arborist explained. Create as much fruit as they can, potential progeny to keep the lineage going. Even cherries cultivated solely for their clouds of pink and white spring flowers will shout a last bonsai. When the Tohoku tsunami roared in on waves that topped 100 feet, traveled inland 6 miles in some places. It destroyed people, houses, temples, highways, trees. Brine shrimp and automobiles were flung like offerings at the feet of Tohoku's cherry trees. Those not ripped out on that March day were soaked in brine, pickled like umeboshi. Nothing could save them. And still, they mustered what they could, commanded hunkered buds to open in great billows, otherworldly in their ghostly beauty, to blot out desolation, decorate despair, a flagrant rapture of blossoms.
Yes, and so this shows an interest that you've had in some Japanese trees, plants. The mention of bonsai, of course, is an exclamation that has to do with what is bonsai in its implication?
Well, for instance, when the Japanese suicide bombers,
yes,
their plane, they yelled bonsai, and I mean, I think it's something to the emperor.
Yes. I think it's some reference to a 1,000-year period, which I thought, if that is so, I see how you brought it in with a tree that can just really continue to go on and on and on. Yeah. And then, of course, you bring in a terrible event, the Tohoku tsunami, which hit that peninsula in, what was it, 2010 or 12?
Somewhere around there, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly, but yes. Yeah.
And then you mentioned this fruit crumpled like umeboshi. Nothing could save them. What is the umeboshi?
Umeboshi are pickled plums. And they're very good for settling your stomach if you have an upset stomach. You make a tea out of them. You also, they're just a common Japanese pickle you have with rice and other things.
Well, many would know that, and it would fit in beautifully. I did have to think about what that might be, but they're umeboshi is a kind of pickled fruit, and the cherry trees and the umeboshi, they were pickled like umeboshi. Nothing could save them. And still they mustered what they could. It is really, I mean, trees don't die. There's nothing but nutriments in a tree even after it stopped producing those things, right? Yeah. So the 1,000 years can go on, but this is a flagrant rapture of blossoms. But I thought when you said to blot out and to decorate despair, that was really good. The way you read that, because there is a duality there. To blot out desolation, decorative could be decorate despair. I love that that oxymoron feeling in those two.
Yeah, sometimes you can't blot out your desolation, and all you can do is decorate what you're left with. So
that's right. That's right. And the struggle that we have to compose ourselves and to have a tranquil thought comes up in Letitia's balloons. You give the person a name in the title, so you have to say the title, but we don't know who it is after that in the poem, whether you're impersonating a Letitia.
All right. This is Letitia's lost balloon. She attempts to meditate, breathes in, breathes out, watches her breath, feeling her abdomen rise and fall. Then she remembers the shattered dining room light fixture. Jagged edges of thought slice the narrow cord of her attention. Her focus floats away, untethered balloon. She blows up another, breathes in and out, two cycles this time. Then the car intrudes. When can she get that hanging side mirror fixed? She recommits to the breath, to the act of meditating, but on the next exhale, it's gone. Come back, she calls to the minuscule balloon.
Great. How many have had that experience of just never being able to get away from the mundane? Yeah, and oh. Letitia. A lot of people named their kids Letitia. I guess in Victorian times it was more common, Letty.
Yes.
You know, but it's a lovely Latin word for joyfulness. It does mean just a jocular, full of good feeling. That's what it is. Laughter is there too in Laetitia. Now this one, I wondered, is this personal too?
There's a bit of personal truth in here, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, within the book, there are two personae. One is Letitia, who has had a go at Lithia, and the other is the deaf woman. So, you know, both of those characters have a bit of me in them, but also, you know, there's poetic license, and you go off and do what you want to do with it, so.
Right.
So this is called, Did You Fail Lithia, or Did It Fail You? Tiny elemental socket wrenches do a turn, sometimes for the good, sometimes not. Beleaguered synapses borrow transmitters, send frantic SOS signals. No one's receiving. Meanwhile, there's the longing for some semblance of sanity, all the marbles cinched safely in a small hand-woven bag, none rolled under the sofa, or used as ball bearings in a Rube Goldberg contraption. Invention is necessity's stepdaughter, waiting for her chance to step up into a waiting pumpkin. When the wheels come off, and they will, lithium works frantically to right the carriage. The inevitable ditch into which everything falls is filled with dank water, toads, milfoil. Word is sent for some desiccant. Word is sent for a sump pump. Word returns empty-handed.
Yeah, gosh, to move the way you do into the fairy tale metaphors, that's just wonderful. To bring that world in, which fantasy, and yet there's got to be that kind of moments of delirium and fantasy in a mind that's going through many mood changes.
Yes.
Yeah. And to grasp on to a metaphor and hold it for a while, what security there must be in latching on to something like that, right? Even though, as you say, it all comes to ditch water. Where's the desiccant? Come on. Where's the sump pump? We need to get out of this one. Yeah. Terrific metaphor for depression and what imagining what further depression can be. The hero's journey. Now here you go into, well, it's not exactly a hero of a thousand faces, but the hero becomes a thousand tourists.
The hero's journey. The hero's journey is now available as a package tour, sponsored by ARP and your alumni association. It begins with a wide circle out from home base, through wild mountains and their dubious inhabitants, Sasquatch, Yeti, Samaveye, Shanhu, through desiccated deserts, random encounters with camel-riding Bedouin, small, sad oases, brilliant rocks. Then onward through snake-infested tropical jungles where scampering monkeys taunt bright-costumed tourists, snatching their water bottles, biting them open. Until at last, somewhere in the Southern Ocean, drifting dangerously close to Antarctica, a hurricane carelessly tosses your cruise ship from crest to trough of 30-foot waves. Over the PA system, the Russian captain intones, "Do not worry, she is strong ship." Confined to your cabin, fed at intervals by a crew member tossing sandwiches from the doorway, you ride out the storm, taking videos out the rollicking porthole. You want to show those who stayed home the fury and sound. You come safely to harbor at the tip of a continent that's drifting at the same rate your fingernails grow. The lack of a manifest seems destined. You have only today this shirt that's your favorite.
I'm glad I could hold off from my chuckling, continent drifting at the same rate that your fingernails grow. The large and the small, yes, it's just great.
There are some bits of truth in that poem. I mean, especially the part in the ship with the crew coming around and tossing us sandwiches because, you know, you had to be kind of basically tied in because we were like this, up and down, up and down.
So you went down into the Antarctic waters, did you? Yeah. Oh, wow. And was the Russian ship a pretty big one? Was it a freighter type?
It was, I'm trying to remember if it was American or British ship, but it was a Russian captain who knew the waters well.
Okay.
It was a small cruise ship with 100 people. It wasn't like one of these big cruises. This was an eco cruise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we got to get off on these various islands on Antarctica itself and walk around and see the penguins and the elephant seals and all that. So
we're going to have a love poem which tells some simple truths too.
Did you want an anniversary song or Gregory?
Yes, the anniversary song, the love poem.
Yes. anniversary song. Listen, love, what I wanted to say dissolved in this afternoon's plummeting rain. Lord knows we need rain, but the timing was off. No umbrella, words written in chalk on my hand. Listen, love, what I meant to say has already molded. Overripe cheese, fuzzy peach in the back of the crisper drawer. Listen, love, what I might have said is in the pants press I gave to Goodwill. What I should have said was festooned with blossoms, garlands of fuchsia crepe paper petals. Listen, love, what I will say is I'm heating the leftovers and supper will be on the table at 6.
Finally get down to brass tacks. But you have quite a little adventure before you get there. Yeah. Trying to find the ways to say what I meant to say. Wow. Yes. Now we go into a relationship of great density, I would have to say. We're going to have a conversation with a rock. Gregory the Stone.
Yes. Ah, Gregory. I remember the day I picked up this rock because he spoke to me, however he did that, saying he was a particular piece of my past I needed to take when I moved back to the city. Not pocket-sized like most of my beach finds, the pebbles, glass shards, and baby crab shells, but a substantial stone, liftable, yet damn hard to carry all that way from Possession Point to the cabin. He says he's named Gregory like the great Pope, kneels now on a small Persian carpet on the floor of my study, not an ounce of anxiety in him. He fills the room with presence, chants in a humble monotone. Is what I hear when I sit and am quiet a congregation of molecules dancing, tingling symbols of silica? Or is this plain chant, monophonic old song? His theology is so 7th century. The desert monks taught him forbearance, how to live with the 8 evil thoughts, hold his own against lust, and etc. But Gregory has trouble with acedia, just can't bring himself to get up and get going. He sits there, distracted. Beautiful mud flows slip through his thoughts. It's time to recite matins, but he figures there's always tomorrow. Gregory regales me with tales of his relatives. He gloats over the pyramids, exults in stone fences that mark out sheep-dotted fields in Ireland. He prefers stones like himself with no artifice, though he greatly admires sculptors, says Michelangelo is one of his heroes. He grows wistful when he describes tall stones standing upright in hinges. They've told him of magic, adventures with little people, celestial happenings. And, of course, there's the stone that sealed up the grave for 3 days. Gregory says that the stone says that he rolled away by himself. It was hard. When I ask how he learned all these stories, he regards me oddly, tells me that we might hear them also if we would be silent enough, draw the slow, twisting tales out of the ether. Jung knew about that. Gregory stoned again, shit-faced, groveling at my feet. I forgive him. It must be hard to be always so contained, the exchange of molecules with the air so slow that it is possible he has never taken a breath. In all the eons of his rocky existence, not once sighed.
Oh, how I've gotten to know Gregory. That is really quite a profile. And yet it does say much about how the pet rock experience even managed to get going. I'm obviously people like rocks. They carry them from the waters. The kids have got pockets full of them. You know, they're attractive things. And what are they doing dancing there still like that without showing declarations? Yeah.
I would think it's very frustrating. So,
oh, yes. Yes. When you want to go, when you want to move and shift, what does it take? Well, you've thought a lot about it. I thought you might have an answer there. All right. And Island Time is also a little bit about the world of Gregory and other friends of Gregory.
Yes. Yeah, I lived for a number of years out on Whidbey Island. And, of course, it often shows up in my poems. So.
Yeah.
Island Time. Out on the island, I know how things mesh, how the tides wash and rinse kelp beds every 6 hours, rising, then falling, shifting month by month, so summer's extremes become the gentle sloshing of equinox. On the island, I know where to pick blackberries, how to find the good cheer thrift store or a farm with fresh eggs. I know which beach yields sand dollars, where to dig clams to pick mussels. I collect driftwood, boil crabs, compose a chowder. Out here, I've learned the patience of herons, studying light and shadow. They wait for ripples. Glints of light stand rooted to one spot, only as long as the fishing is good, keep their own schedules. From my cabin, I look east at the hulk of the mainland, glad to be where time is elastic, stretches and snaps back, long line trolling me through seasons of decision and desire.
Yeah, wonderful to live by a coast where there's so much life. And the time is told by moons and tides and so much. Yes, the stretching and the snapping back. very, very, very kinetic feeling there about time. Yes, love it. Love it very much. Island Time. So you lived on Whidbey for when you first came, or was it after you'd been in Seattle for some time? Whidbey Island. When yes. You first arrived, or was it?
No, that was actually, we bought it in 74 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then my husband and I divorced, and then I moved to live on the island and on Possession Point, a little cabin down there. So,
right. When you mentioned Possession Point, I had a feeling that you either had a cabin or you'd lived close to some water, you know, on the shore. And so as you go on, you do have an interesting life, but you try once in a while in your poetry. This one shows form. I mean, it's not that you try it all the time, and no poet needs to wrench themselves into one of these straitjackety forms, right?
But
you try, you do the villanelle here, a version of the villanelle.
Yes, yeah, there's really only a couple poems that are in forms in the book, Risking It. I mean, there is a sonnet and there is a guzzle, but and then there's this villanelle. So, mm-hmm. Honeyed days. I used to believe old age was absurd, expected to live hard and die early. How astounding I'm writing these words. You know that proverb about early birds? I guess worms are okay if you're hungry. I used to believe old age was absurd, sedate minuet on a harpsichord. But even minuets can swing jively. How astounding I'm humming these words, not laid out in a box made of pine boards or just fragments the rest up the chimney. I used to believe old age was absurd, now enjoy honeyed days unfettered. To someone the object of envy, How astounding, I'm thinking these words. It turns out that life is a smorgasbord. Mortality, frugality, chutney. I used to believe old age was absurd. How astounding, I'm singing these words.
Yes, the smorgasbord. Again, your wit with that chutney at the end. You give these grand abstractions, mortality, frugality, then chutney. Should be there in the smorgasbord somewhere. Now, I heard a few electronic glitches at one point, and so if you would, could you read the middle stanza, sedate minuet on a harpsichord, down to down to how astounding I'm thinking these words. The three right there. We might need to fill those in because I did hear a little glitch, sort of an electronic sound.
Yes. Sedate minuet on a harpsichord. But even minuets can swing jively. How astounding I'm humming these words, not laid out in a box made of pine boards, or just fragments, the rest up the chimney. I used to believe old age was absurd, now enjoy honeyed days unfettered. To some, I'm the object of envy. How astounding I'm thinking these words.
Good. That sounded just as clear as a bell. Those are honeyed days. And I thought perhaps you were going into some apiary study when I saw the honeyed days, but it's a great word for all kinds of beautiful things, colored things, even to mind amber and other things like that. But you are again going to take us into a much more serious time and death study, the deaf woman.
The deaf woman, time, and death. Whether the deaf woman is feeling renewal, mania, or just a New Year's jolt, only time will tell, and time is a remarkably open-ended, closed-mouthed, artificial construct, the awareness of which makes humans twitchy. Time goes fast, slow, creeps at a pretty or petty pace, is immemorial, or a fresh new day, flies like an arrow, a bullet, an aerialist, plods through mud, wounds, and heals. The deaf woman has already lived most of her allotted time on this planet. She's eager to plan her next adventure. The deaf woman searches online for a travel agent, trip advisor, cruise director, flight instructor, wilderness guide. She finds ministers, rabbis, priests, imams, monks, nuns. They offer glossy tracks, flight insurance, parables about lost baggage, conflicting description of what to expect when arriving at the afterlife. The deaf woman swallows the explanations with a large grain of salt, chokes, spits them out. She wonders whether death will be salty, sweet, bitter, savory, piquant, sour, or will death taste umami, fashioned from soy sauce and maple syrup. The deaf woman is upset by the lack of experimental data. All the available facts are anecdotal stories told by people who left the normal realm of consciousness, traveled down corridors, attended reunions, saw sights and lights, smelled smells, came back empty-handed. Who doesn't bring back a souvenir, a memento, a tchotchke from the trip of a lifetime?
And it's, did you think you're in a Japanese world at times, bringing in the umami flavor? Again, there's that hint of Japan.
I've been there four times.
Yes, so it
I love Japan, so
right. It's infused in you some definite tastes and thoughts and memories probably of things you did. I think that this is really a very charming poem, even though it's trying to imagine something that's, oh, something perhaps that gives anxiety to some people. You know, what is this? Is there an in-between place too? Yes. Are we going to be stuck sweeping sidewalks for a long time before we're given a chance to get across the road?
I love that.
Yeah. There was a lovely film called Afterlife that was a Japanese film in which people were stranded in the anteroom, and they had to imagine a scenario in which they would fit in the afterlife. And so they had to pick something from their real lives, imagine it, and have a film made of it so that they could belong in it when they went to the afterlife.
That's great, yes.
But yeah. There were some that just went on sweeping the sidewalks, raking the leaves. The apricot tree is one that will perhaps need some sweeping up after the springtime's passed, but it really is another struggling life that's going to do its best forever.
Yeah, it's trying. The apricot tree. The apricot's in bloom again, old gangly tree that crafts a single fruit or two each year, yet decks herself in copious flowers, eager for pollen, although there's not another tree for miles to partner her. You know, she keeps blooming year after year. It's her nature, not a conscious choice. She never thought, I don't do blossoms anymore. Deciduous, driven, her moss-mottled branches intertwine like nests. She lifts her thousand blossoms to the sky, says, use me.
How we can, we talk to the trees. We do want them to be alive even to us. And,
yes.
And yet we learn from them probably a lot more than they have learned from humanity. We have done such a dreadful job of orcharding.
No, we treat them like adversaries, and they're our friends, in fact, our saviors sometimes. So,
right. Well, I really can't thank you enough for bringing summertime in with your poems. We've had a perfect blossoming tree that's just hanging on at the very end, and these have been the poems of Sylvia Pollack, Sylvia Byrne Pollack of Seattle, and we are so grateful that you had time to do this with us. Thanks for coming on the program, Sylvia.
Thank you so very much for having me. This has been a joy.
I loved it too. This is Sound Poetry, and I've been your host, David Gilmore. Goodbye.